coming. My name is Robert Shepherd, and I'm filling in for Dr. Ben Hopkins today. He's on his way back from the Asian Studies meeting. So, and we're very honored to have, I'm going to mispronounce it, I'm going to try, Dr. Usten Tuju. Kind of close. Okay. The Norwegian Institute of Defense Studies. Dr. Tuja has, his PhD is from the University of Wales. He's also studied, he has a master's from London School of Economics and a master's from Griffith University. And he's been a visiting Fulbright scholar at the Fairbanks Center at Harvard University. And he's here today to share with us his findings from his most recent book on geostructural realism as a concept to understand the U.S.-China relationship, I guess I'd say. And we have some visuals for you, so I'm going to move out of the way so as you talk we can see that, right? So thank you for...
Well, thank you for the introduction. Let me thank the Secure Center for hosting me here today. Can you hear me in the back, even if I don't use a microphone? Or? It's fine?
Good.
Good. I'm here to present a book I published last year called The Return of Bipolarity in World Politics, China, the United States, and Geostructural Realism. And this book argues, well, it's actually the first book that I come across that argues that we are at the starting point of a new bipolar international system with the United States and China as the two superpowers, but with this system concentrated on East Asia in comparison to the previous bipolar system concentrated on Europe. And in order to analyze this new bipolar system, I took Kenneth Wald's structural realism as a starting point, but I quickly realized that this structural realist theory doesn't work that well. And I reconfigure it, and I called it geostructural realism. And I will, you know, try to explain this to you. But first, if you recall Kenneth Wald's structural realist theory, he basically made three arguments. The first is that balancing differs between a bipolar and a multipolar system. The second is that a bipolar system is more stable than a multipolar system. And thirdly, that the superpowers tend to be rivals in the periphery, or the Third World War, as it was called during the Cold War period. Wald's theory couldn't really explain the unipolar era that we've been through for the last 30 years. Structural realism has been sort of dead for 30 years. But now I try to bring it back to life, but then I think we need to reconfigure this theory by adding one variable, which is geopolitics, into this structural realist theory. I will get much more into detail about this core argument of the book, but before we actually can get there, we have to sort of, not necessarily agree, but I have to explain to you why we are at the starting point of a new bipolar system, or else the sort of the train doesn't leave the station. And there are three arguments for why we are at the starting point of a new bipolar system. And the first is that the power gap between China and the United States has narrowed considerably, even though China is not as powerful as the United States. The second argument is that the power gap between China and the rest, whether it's Japan, whether it's Russia, India, has grown and widened immensely over the last two decades. And third argument is that the distribution of capabilities, that means who are the most powerful states in the international system today, are very similar to the origins of the previous bipolar system. So I'll take you through those three arguments with some graphics to illustrate this. Firstly, when it comes to the power gap between the United States narrowing, measured in purchasing power parity, Chinese economy is today the largest in the world, about 25% larger than the US economy. But this is probably not a good indicator of economic strength. In nominal terms, the Chinese economy is about 65% of the US economy. If we look at exports, China is by far the largest exporting country in the world. And if you look at currency reserves, China has gone from having 1/6 to having today about 24 times more currency reserves than the United States. This gives China a lot of economic leverage, but as I said in the introduction, China is not economically as powerful as the United States. If we look at the military, it's kind of the big numbers here. We again see the same patterns. The gap between the United States and China are narrowing, but China is not as militarily strong as the United States. I don't have time to go into specific capabilities, but I will argue later that the main sort of geopolitical difference between the current bipolar system and the previous bipolar system is that the rivalry is at sea instead of on land. So I think these numbers on the navies are quite important. And measured in number of ships, China today has the biggest navy in the world. And they are likely to increase that gap in the years to come. The US ambition to build a 355-ship navy, whether they will actually be able to do that or not, there are question marks around that. But even if they would succeed with that, it would not be enough to close the gap to China. Of course, again, there are issues about quality and quantity. The US Navy is, of course, much more powerful than the Chinese Navy. It has experience, it has operated globally for decades. And also, if we have measured this differently, for instance, not in the number of ships, but in tonnage, the picture would look different. But at the same time, quantity has a quality of itself. So one ship can only be one place at one time. And the US has, well, some things that having allies is a strength, and yes, it might be, but actually in this case, the United States has global responsibilities. It means that its navy has to operate globally. It means that there will be less ships to deal with China, who primarily operates in the East Asian waters. So taking this into consideration, I think this is a very interesting trend, and it speaks to the closing military power gap between the United States and China. It's not just that China is building a number of ships, they're also sailing them, and this is a satellite image from last year, where the Northern Fleet is exercising with the Southern Fleet in the South China Sea, and they are escorting China's only aircraft carrier through the South China Sea. It's more than 40 ships, everything from submarines to frigates, destroyers, and so forth. And this is a very interesting sign of China's ambitions and signaling. And this picture also takes me to the second point. I focused first on the narrowing power gap between the United States and China. Now I move to the second argument about China and the rest. Because I don't know whether you remember when the Russians deployed their only aircraft carrier to the Mediterranean a couple of years ago to do strikes in Syria. There was this black smoke coming out of the Russian aircraft carrier. And it wasn't really a proper aircraft carrier battle group exporting it. It was this boat that were there, towing boat, I don't know the English word for it, but they were there to rescue if they had engineering problems. And I mean, that speaks a lot, but it does give you a number, which maybe doesn't tell you much, but in 2016, China commissioned 18 ships. Everything from submarines, frigates, destroyers, and so forth, logistic ships. And in 2016, the total tonnage of those ships were 150,000 tons. And in 2016, that was about half the size of the UK Navy. So in 1 year, China put to sea half the size of the UK Navy. So that puts China's ambitions into some perspective, at least from a European point of view. And if I asked you, to raise your hand, those of you who know how much larger China's economy is compared to Russia. I don't know how many, but I doubt it. It's many. Because every time I give this talk, very few are aware of how much larger China's GDP is compared to Russia in nominal terms. Anyone want to take a guess? Yeah?
Well, I think Russia's GDP is about $1 trillion, isn't it?
So how much bigger is China's?
China's, I think, 6 or 7 times.
Six, right? Or seven? It's not too bad. So China's economy is roughly 10 times bigger in nominal GDP than Russia's. Russia is down here with a GDP about the same size as Spain. So the important trend that we've seen over the last 2 decades is that the gap between China and the United States is narrowing, but this gap has increased enormously. So it's not many years ago, people around town, especially at the World Bank, IMF, many places in Washington, were talking about the BRICS countries. We probably don't hear that much about it anymore. But if you take out China from BRICS, and you look at Brazil, Russia, India, South Africa, these 4 countries combined have less than half of China's nominal GDP. So my argument is that China is very much in a class of its own compared to all these potential powers, that the BRICS and the talk about multipolarity is misguided. We can do similar things with the military. So China has roughly about the same in the early 1990s as Russia and India, half of what Germany and Japan is spending on the military, and then it increases a lot. And by 2017, according to CIPRI, China has 4 times bigger defense spending than Russia, more than 4 times bigger than Germany and Japan. So the third argument is that the distribution of capabilities in the international system today is roughly similar to the starting point of the previous bipolar system. And this is a quote from Barry Poston, but many others have pointed this out, that of course the Soviet Union was never as powerful as the United States during the previous bipolar system. So China doesn't need to be as powerful as the United States today for it to be a new bipolar international system. And what sort of was important to go from the big three, and even T.R. Fox talked about the three superpowers in 1944, Churchill, Roosevelt, Stalin, the United States, Soviet Union, and the United Kingdom, that was the big three in 1945, but then just 5 years later, there were only 2 left, 2 superpowers, the United States and the Soviet Union. And we had entered a bipolar system for the first time. And it was the gap between the Soviet Union and the United Kingdom that really defined this new bipolar system. Not that there was a power gap between the Soviet Union and the United States. In that period, for instance, the Soviet Union didn't even have nuclear weapons. Not even close to having the kind of military or the economy as the United States. So if we go back and compare the classic politics among nations, and you look at the first edition in 1948, and you compare that edition to the second edition published in 1954, you see how Hans Morgenthau was struggling to really work this out. In the first edition, he doesn't use the word superpowers. He speaks about the great powers. He acknowledged that Britain is not as powerful as the United States and the Soviet Union, but he still hasn't concluded that we have 2 superpowers and we are at the bipolar system. But in 54, in the second edition, it's very clear. We had 2 superpowers for the first time in history, or at least in the modern state system, and we are in a bipolar system. And why is that? Because the gap between those 2 and the 3rd has become so large. And it's exactly the same argument I'm making today. The gap between China and the United States and the rest has become so large that we have now arrived at the new bipolar international system. So why does this matter? Why is polarity so important? Why did I spend 15 minutes, half of my talk, to explain this? Well, because it shapes all states' room for maneuver. You can pick any state in the international system, and they are pushed and shoved by the international structures and the system. So you take a small state like Norway, and you look at Norway's history from 1905, when Norway became independent, and up until today, it's gone through multipolar, bipolar, unipolar, and now the new system. So in the multipolar system, Norway saw neutrality. Didn't work that well. We were attacked by Germany in the Second World War, and we learned a lesson. And in the bipolar system, we entered an alliance with the United States. And this completely changed Norwegian defense and security policy. And then the Soviet Union collapsed. We entered a unipolar system. When I lecture for officers at the Norwegian Defense University College, I tell them, you're waging war in Afghanistan, you participated in military operations in the Balkans, you've been bombing in Libya. All these use of military force would have been unthinkable in a bipolar system. Nobody in Norway in 1980 were even thinking of sending Norwegian soldiers to fight a war in Afghanistan or participating in the military operations on the Balkans or in bombing in Libya. So it was the new conditions, the unipolar international system, that made it possible for Norway to completely change its foreign and defense policy. And similar for, I would argue, for the United States. Think about the United States' role in a multipolar system during the First and the Second World War. It didn't even take part in the First World War until 1917. In the movie Dunkirk, Churchill is calling Roosevelt, begging for the United States to support Britain against Germany, but the United States did not do anything. So in a multipolar system, the United States has a different room to maneuver. In a bipolar system, the United States wanted to pull back its troops from Europe, but it was clear to the Truman administration in the post-Second World War period that the United States was the only power that could balance the Soviet Union. So it created a very different room. And of course, the unipolar era had created totally new room for maneuver for the United States. Theoretically, we want to use polarity just to explain two things. The first is balancing, or the rivalry between the top-ranking states. And this is simply summarizing Kenneth Walt's structural realist theory. So in a multipolar system, you rely on internal and external balancing. In a bipolar system, you mainly rely on internal balancing. And then you have different dynamics in these different international systems. So what was the problem prior to World War I? It was this chain ganging, that Germany had to felt compelled to support Austria-Hungary after the shooting in Sarajevo in the summer of 1914. France and Russia were in this mobilization plans, two flanks, trying to press the Germans, and all of this was a major factor causing the First World War. In the Second World War, you had a different problem. You had the buck passing. So nobody stood up to Hitler. And the whole point Waltz argues in his theory is that that kind of dynamic, which you saw before the First and the Second World War, will not happen in a bipolar system, because you only have two superpowers. So the dynamic is very different. And the Suez Crisis, for instance, shows this. The United States were not compelled to support France and the United Kingdom when they colluded with Israel and attacked Nasser's Egypt in 1956. Instead, he undermined completely their military operation. And this clearly showed that the French and the British were no longer among the top-ranking powers. And why did they do that? Because they want to make sure that the Soviet Union did not use this military operation to get a foothold in the Middle East. So you have a different dynamic. And then out of this comes the argument about stability, that a bipolar system with only two superpowers will be more stable than a multipolar system. And in many ways, Walz got it right. He wrote this already in 1964, again in 1979, and the Cold War and the long peace very much confirmed his predictions. The problem, as I pointed to in the introduction, there is nobody who has compared two bipolar systems. So we cannot take Walt's theory and make predictions and explanations of whether the new bipolar system with the United States and China will be more or less stable than the bipolar system with the United States and the Soviet Union. And we cannot take Walt's theory to explain why the balancing we are seeing between the United States and China today differs so much from the balancing we saw between the United States and the Soviet Union in the early 1950s. So I then developed these three arguments in the second part of my book. The first argument being that strong balancing and arms racing is postponed today because of geopolitical factors. And the second argument is that the risk of war is not high, but it is relatively higher than during the previous bipolar system because of geopolitical factors. And also, thirdly, because of geopolitical factors, I predict that we will see less proxy wars in the periphery as we saw in the previous bipolar system. I think those are three pretty important arguments about US-China rivalry in the 21st century. So why is it that geopolitics is so important? Well, two factors. I'll try to simplify. The first thing about East Asia is that none of US allies are bordering China. It's an obvious geographical fact, but it's a very, very important matter. And the second point is that there is water between US allies and China. An added sea in East Asia today, and also for the foreseeable future, well, I shouldn't say maybe foreseeable, but at least for a decade or two, the United States is likely to be conventionally superior compared to China. Okay? Two very important arguments. If you think back to Europe, completely the opposite. Several of US allies were bordering the Soviet Union or Warsaw Pact and were looking across the land border and seeing the mighty Red Army. And in Europe, the United States were conventionally inferior to the Soviet Union on the ground. What was the answer to that?
Nuclear weapons.
Exactly, nuclear weapons. Massive retaliation, mutually assured destruction. Okay? So in Europe, you got this tense situation, arms raising, but at the same time, you got stability. You get the East-West divide, you get Checkpoint Charlie and a Berlin Wall, you get percentage agreements, you get spares of influences, you get red lines and tripwires. And nobody dares cross them, because you risk escalating into a Third World War with nuclear weapons. In East Asia, it's very different. There is no red lines. There is no East-West divide. There is no percentage agreement. There is no spares of influences. There are no buffer zones. There are no tripwires. And also, because the United States is conventionally superior at sea in East Asia, it doesn't need to threaten China with nuclear weapons. Some may think that's a good thing, but it does create more instability. So these are fishing boats and coast guard ships, and these are around the Senkaku Islands. But the whole thing is just to show an image that this is very unstable compared to the situation in Europe and the East-West divide. In addition to this, you see in the background the Senkaku Islands, or what the Chinese call the Diu Islands, and these are sovereignty issues for China. Taiwan is a sovereignty issue for China. South China Sea is a sovereignty issue for China. The Soviet Union didn't have any sovereignty claims over West Berlin or West Germany in Europe. It was a status quo power